The thrill of forging your own path is powerful. Nissan is bringing that thrill to our community in collaboration with the Black Effect Podcast Network to create The Thrill of Possibility, a community impact program and summit curated to support HBCU students in science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics, or STEAM, and introduce them to exclusive opportunities. Nissan is committed to creating opportunity for the whole community and ensuring that Black excellence is a part of the new future of automotive. For more information about this program and how to apply, visit blackeffect.com/Nissan.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. We had a great time recording this episode for you guys before heading to our iHeartRadio Music Festival in Las Vegas. Thanks to Hyundai for making this possible. Here's a little taste. Let's play the game where I list an artist and let's watch you sing one of their songs.
Yes.
Oh, boy, this is going to be
Black
tough.
Black Eyed Peas.
I got a feeling
good.
Tonight's going to be
okay, just
good.
Stop.
Good
hey, night. Just stop. Stop while you're
ahead. Lionel Richie.
You're beautiful.
That's no, James Blunt. No.
Okay.
Okay.
Lionel Richie. Hello.
No, that's Adele from the other side.
Similar-ish, but Lionel Richie was first. Pat Benatar. I give you the first word. Hit.
Hit me, baby, one more time.
Close.
Close. So close.
That's Britney Spears.
Oh, that is.
This episode brought to you by the first ever fully electric Hyundai Ioniq 5.
With the Starbucks app, you can make a moment with a tap. So next time you order your morning coffee, treat someone else and make their day. To tell them you're grateful for them, or that you've got their back, or simply to say thanks. Share the moment. Download the Starbucks app.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell stories about everything here on this show, from the arts to sports, and from business to history, and everything in between, including your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. They're some of our favorites. Mark Metcalf is an actor often identified as playing the role of an antagonist. He is best known for his role as the sadistic ROTC officer Douglas T. Niedermeyer in the 1978 comedy Animal House, a character he later emulated in the 1984 music videos for the songs We're Not Gonna Take It and I Wanna Rock by the heavy metal hair band Twisted Sister. He is also known for playing the role of the maestro on the hit sitcom Seinfeld. Mark Metcalf sat down with Greg Hengler and shared his story. Here's Mark.
I was born in Findlay, Ohio, which is the home of Tasty Taters and where Ben Roethlisberger grew up and lived. In fact, in Hancock County, where Findlay, Ohio is, which is about 75 miles south of Toledo, I'm the second most famous person to ever come out of Findlay, Ohio, according to the Chamber of Commerce or whoever makes those things up. Ben Roethlisberger is number one, and I'm number two, but that's all right. I'll take number two. So I was born there. My mom was from Ohio, and my dad was from Missouri, St. Louis. And they met during the war in 45, I guess. My mother was a wave, and she was decoding messages in an office in Washington, D.C. My dad, who had served most of the war on a carrier in the Pacific, was back doing some intelligence work, analysis, and things like that. My mother lived in a house. She used to tell this story. My mother lived in a house with five other women, all involved in the war effort, and my father used to come up to their house for dinner, and every one of the women, except my mother, thought that he was going to ask one of them to marry them. He was a good-looking guy, and he was in uniform, and he was a smart guy and a nice guy, and they all thought, except for my mother, she thought, because she was kind of tall and a little gawky, and they never thought that he would ask her, but he asked her. And my mother one time showed me the house that where I was conceived in Washington. And I was really surprised. But she proudly told me, pointed out the house on a little street in Chevy Chase, said you were conceived in that house. So it's nice to know where you started. So after I was born, and then I went back to St. Louis because my father had a job when he got out of the Navy. He had a job in engineering. He had graduated from University of Wisconsin-Madison in engineering. He graduated early. I think he was 20 when he graduated. Went to school at 16. He was a real smart guy. He worked on the crew at Sverdrup and Parsow that designed the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, which is a 23-mile-long combination bridge and tunnel across the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. National Geographic called it the eighth engineering wonder of the world. And he was put in charge of all the tunnel work. And he became the kind of engineer who at one point was called the world's foremost expert on tunnels. And I hung out with him. There are two shipping channels in and out of the mouth of Chesapeake Bay. They couldn't build bridges over them because they were the Navy shipping channels. All the Norfolk warships come in and out of the mouth of Chesapeake Bay. So they had to build tunnels under these, because if you build a bridge over it, the enemy could bomb the bridge into the channel and block it. So they had to build four islands, and then they brought the tunnel tubes up from Texas on big barges, and then they filled them with water and sank them, put them into the... It was kind of an amazing engineering feat. And that inspired me in a lot of ways to go to college as an engineer. I went to the University of Michigan and quickly discovered that engineering was not really for me. It was a little dry. But I didn't know how dry it was until I got... my roommate, my sophomore year, said, come audition for a couple of plays. They're doing the three parts of Henry VI. And the girls are really friendly in the theater department. That's what he told me. And he was right. The girls were a lot friendlier in the theater department. And I got cast in, I think, 15 different parts. And that kind of hooked me, because it seemed like everybody in the Metcalf background was either a minister, Congregationalist minister, or a librarian, or an engineer. So I went from that rather dry atmosphere to this theater, backstage in the theater, where everybody's yelling and screaming at each other one minute and making out passionately the next minute. And so it's like, oh, brave new world, what creatures are there here? As Miranda says at the end of The Tempest, it was really kind of magnificent and an eye-opener, and I got stuck in it, and I've been doing it ever since. So I just got to, and I really got into theater. I never thought I'd get a degree in it. I changed from engineering to architecture because it was a little bit more creative. You had to claim a major, so I claimed English was my major for a while, psychology was my major for a while, forestry was my major for a while, and I ended up with my degree in theater because it was the only thing I was taking classes in. I just stopped going to classes except for theater classes. In fact, they tried to flunk me out because my grades were so bad, and the theater department, all the teachers in the theater department wrote letters to the teachers in the English department, the teachers in the French department, the teachers, all the classes I was failing because I wasn't going. And they said, you can't fail him. You've got to give him, get him a tutor. We'll get him a tutor. Get him a passing grade because we need him to do plays. So I became like a theater jock, the way football players got to take the easiest classes and got automatic A's because they were on the football team at University of Michigan anyway. And that's how I got my degree. And I'm ashamed of that. No, I'm not that ashamed of it, but I'm a little embarrassed by it.
And you're listening to Mark Metcalf tell his story. We continue with his story here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com.
Hey, you guys, this is Tori and Jenny with the 9021 OMG podcast. We have such a special episode brought to you by Nurtec ODT. We recorded it at iHeartRadio's 10th poll event, Wango Tango. Did you know that Nurtec ODT Remegipant 75 milligrams can help migraine sufferers still attend such an exciting event like Wango Tango. It's true. I had one that night and I took my Nurtec ODT and I was present and had an amazing time. Here's a little glimpse of our conversation with some of our closest friends. This episode was brought to you by Nurtec ODT Remegipant 75 milligrams. Life with migraine attacks can mean missing out on big moments with friends and family. But thankfully, Nurtec ODT Remegipant 75 milligrams is the only medication that is proven to treat a migraine attack and prevent episodic migraines in adults. So lively events like Wango Tango don't have to be missed.
Hey, everyone. It's Anahat O'Connor here, and I'll be your host on Chasing Sleep, a brand new podcast from Mattress Firm and iHeartRadio, where we'll uncover the sleep secrets that help us achieve some of the world's most extraordinary feats. As a health columnist, I'm passionate about learning and sharing how we can live and sleep better. And when it comes to sleep, we can all enhance it to reach our own goals. That's why on Chasing Sleep, we'll be chatting with people who live, work, and perform in some of the most incredible environments and see how they not only find quality sleep in unique circumstances, how they also use their sleep to perform at the highest level. Together, we'll discover how these impressive individuals approach sleeping well, from astronauts in space to wildlife photographers in the remote wilderness, and learn to get high-quality sleep in our own lives. Alongside the sleep experts at Mattress Firm, join me as we dive in, because ultimately, we all benefit from sleeping well. And when we do, we can all find new ways to live well, too. Listen to Chasing Sleep on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? It's Dramos. You may know me from the recap on LA TV. Now I've got my own podcast, Life as a Gringo, coming to you every Tuesday and Thursday. We'll be talking real and unapologetic about all things life, Latin culture, and everything in between from someone who's never quite fit in. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And we're back with Our American Stories and with Mark Metcalf's story. Starting off as an engineering major, an English major, a forestry major. I didn't know there was such a thing. And ultimately, well, he becomes, as he put it, a theater jock, being bailed out by all the folks in the theater department who wanted to save him from his own academic failings. And Mark Metcalf, by the way, well, you know him as Niedermeyer in Animal House, and you've seen him in Twisted Sister videos, the maestro in Seinfeld, and the master in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Let's continue with Mark Metcalf's story.
When I graduated, I actually wanted to go to graduate school because I wanted to learn more about the theater, but also I didn't want to go to Vietnam. I didn't think the war was a great thing, but primarily I didn't want to go fight it because I thought I'd be really good at it. I knew enough about myself to know that I was good at taking orders and good at giving orders. So I fit in that military hierarchy like a cog in that wheel. And I didn't want to become that guy. So I acted him later on when I did Niedermeyer. I sort of acted that guy because I knew where that guy lived inside me and I thought I would be good at it, but I didn't want to become him. I wanted to become something else. I didn't know what it was, but I wanted to become something else. So when I graduated, I just took off for the West Coast. I hitchhiked. I got one ride all the way to San Francisco from Ann Arbor. Guy had, I can't remember his name, but he had a 1948 pickup truck that you had to jump start every time you started it. So whenever we stopped for gas, we had to try to find a gas station where you could push it pretty easily to jump start it. Whenever we stopped for the night and slept in the back, which is what we did, or camped, we had to park it on a hill so we'd get up in the morning and jump start it really easily. And it ran out of oil about every 120 miles. So we had to carry oil with us. We were real cowboys. We had a great time. But it took us 2 weeks or so to get across the country to San Francisco. He dropped me off in San Francisco, because that's where I thought the Summer of Love was 1968. It turns out the Summer of Love was 1967. And by 68, it had gotten pretty sour. The day before I arrived on Haight-Ashbury, two kids had died because somebody had sold them acid that was Drano. It just a capsule, and it was Drano, and ate through their stomach, and they died. So it was a it wasn't peace love granola. It was the dirty side of being a hippie. I stayed there for a while, and then I hitchhiked down to L.A., and then I felt like I needed to keep moving because the draft board was still looking for me, I guess. I didn't talk to my parents, so I didn't want them to know where I was because my parents were the kind of people that would have told the draft board where I was so they could come and get me, and I didn't want to be gotten. So I hitchhiked up to, I drove up to Portland first and then took a right and went out to Mount Hood. But I got a job as the assistant in the rental and repair shop. So I had to learn how to repair skis. After I'd been there for a couple of months, I was skiing on rental skis. And I had a pair of skis back home with in my parents' house in New Jersey. So I contacted my parents and I asked them if they'd send my headmasters. And they did, but they put in the box with the skis, they put the letter from the draft board saying you have to show up at a certain time and a certain date in Newark, New Jersey for your physical. And this is kind of person that I was then and still am probably. My figuring was that if I never got the letter, it didn't matter. But once I had the letter, I had to do it. But I really didn't want to do it. So I tried to get into Canada. I tried to walk into Canada. I got a ride up to the way up in the Panhandle. Got a ride a little north of there. And then I got out and I just thought, I'll walk. Canada's just over there on the map, like an inch away, 100 miles. I can walk 100 miles through the wilderness. I'd been living in the wilderness. But no, it's real tough country up there. So I hitchhiked back closer towards Seattle. I thought, I'll go across on a road rather than try to cross in the middle of the wilderness. And I got to the border, and Bob Schmaltz, knowing I was trying to get out of the country, had given me his driver's license, and not his passport, but his driver's license. And I think I even had a birth certificate of his, but I changed my name because I figured in my stone paranoid state that the government would be looking for me at the border. That's why I had to sneak across. So I tried to go across as Bob Schmaltz, but I got turned away at the border because they found my two different sets of ID as Bob Schmaltz and as Mark Metcalf, and they didn't want me in Canada because I looked bad. And I was, I had long hair down the middle of my back, dirty on the road. I wore high fringed moccasins. I was a hippie. So I hitchhiked back to New Jersey. I didn't have a lot of guys from my high school were there at the same time, and they all had briefcases filled with letters from doctors about their bone spurs and or whatever else they might have had that kept them from going to Vietnam. And I didn't have any of that stuff, but I was just really crazy. And they saw that right away, and they gave me a 4F, so I didn't have to worry about it anymore. So they had these auditions in Chicago for regional theaters all over the country, and I did that, and they got offered a job at Milwaukee Rep. So I went to Milwaukee and did a season up there, and when that season was over, they didn't hire anybody back. And so I didn't know where to go or what to do. And a bunch of the people that had been working there were from New York and were heading to New York to try to work in the theater in New York. And I just went to New York. And so for the next 25 years, I lived on St. Mark's Place between 1st and A from 1970 until 1993. So I guess 23 years. The first 5 years I was in New York, I didn't want to do movies or TV. I just said no to all that because it was beneath me. I was a stage actor. I wanted to do Shakespeare and Chekhov and Ibsen and people like that. But they pay you nice money. And the first movie I ever did, I was doing a play on Broadway called Streamers. And somebody saw it, and they had me come in and audition for... I didn't even have to audition. I just had to meet with the producer and the director. Fred Zinnemann directed it. It was a movie called Julia. They were going to shoot it in England. I only had 3 days. It was a one-scene part with Jane Fonda. And I quit the play I was doing to play Streamers in New York for Joe Papp. And I lived in England for 6 weeks. I worked for 3 days. They paid me for 6 weeks. I thought this is what the movies were always like. You got to go to fancy places. They paid you way too much money. And you got to do work that was just plain fun. And so I thought the movies were like that. So I started saying yes to movies. It turns out they're not all like that. But they're mostly fun for the most part. The next one I did was Animal House. A friend of mine named John Hurd, he and I lived across the street from each other. I was living with a woman named Pamela Reed, an actress, was engaged to marry her. And he was living with a wonderful woman named Patrizia Triani. And we went to see a play in Central Park, but we took a picnic. And Pamela and Patrizia made potato salad and fried chicken. And it was a real American feast. And while we're sitting there outside the theater, this big, heavy guy with long hair, big face, comes walking towards us. And John Hurd, who had lived in Chicago and worked in Chicago for a while, he had met John there because John had been working at Second City there. So he said, "Hey, John, come on over here." Nobody knew who John Belushi was, but we invited him to sit down, have some chicken if you want. What are you doing?
And you've been listening to the story of Mark Metcalf. And what a story indeed. From hippie trying to escape the draft to actually going to Newark for all the right reasons and somehow avoiding becoming that person, that guy he didn't want to be. When we come back, more of the life story of Mark Metcalf here on Our American Stories.
You guys, this is Tori and Jenny with the 9021 OMG podcast. We have such a special episode brought to you by Nurtec ODT. We recorded it at iHeartRadio's 10th pole event, Wango Tango. Did you know that Nurtec ODT Remegipant 75 milligrams can help migraine sufferers still attend such an exciting event like Wango Tango? It's true. I had one that night and I took my Nurtec ODT and I was present and had an amazing time. Here's a little glimpse of our conversation with some of our closest friends. This episode was brought to you by Nurtec ODT Remegipant 75 milligrams. Life with migraine attacks can mean missing out on big moments with friends and family. But thankfully, Nurtec ODT Remegipant 75 milligrams is the only medication that is proven to treat a migraine attack and prevent episodic migraines in adults. So lively events like Wango Tango don't have to be missed.
Hey everyone, it's Anahad O'Connor here, and I'll be your host on Chasing Sleep, a brand new podcast from Mattress Firm and iHeartRadio, where we'll uncover the sleep secrets that help us achieve some of the world's most extraordinary feats. As a health columnist, I'm passionate about learning and sharing how we can live and sleep better. And when it comes to sleep, we can all enhance it to reach our own goals. That's why on Chasing Sleep, we'll be chatting with people who live, work, and perform in some of the most incredible environments and see how they not only find quality sleep in unique circumstances, how they also use their sleep to perform at the highest level. Together, we'll discover how these impressive individuals approach sleeping well, from astronauts in space to wildlife photographers in the remote wilderness, and learn to get high-quality sleep in our own lives. Alongside the sleep experts at Mattress Firm, join me as we dive in, because ultimately, we all benefit from sleeping well. And when we do, we can all find new ways to live well, too. Listen to Chasing Sleep on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? It's Dramos. You may know me from the Recap on LA TV. Now I've got my own podcast, Life as a Gringo, coming to you every Tuesday and Thursday. We'll be talking real and unapologetic about all things life, Latin culture, and everything in between from someone who's never quite fit in. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And we're back with Our American Stories and the story of Mark Metcalf. Let's pick up where we left off with Mark telling the story of bumping into then-unknown John Belushi while enjoying a picnic with his friend John Hurd, who, by the way, is the father in the movie Home Alone, and their girlfriends in New York City. Here again is Mark Metcalf.
And he starts to tell us this story about how they wanted him to do this live sketch comedy show on television late night, 11:30 on Saturday nights. And Lorne Michaels, this crazy guy, wanted to do it. And Belushi said, I don't want to do it. I went in there to see him, and I told him, I don't want to work in the system. I want to work outside the system. I want to tear the system down because the system is evil and bad. And Lorne Michaels said very calmly, while Belushi is ranting and raving, said, well, the best way to tear the system down is to work inside the system, so why don't you do this? Because this is not a system kind of thing. So he was trying to make up his mind whether to do this thing or not. And he must have talked for 45 minutes. We sat there for an hour listening to him. We'd say, John, it's TV. It's money. How can you turn it down? It's live TV and you do sketch comedy. Imagine, it's just like doing theater. What a great thing. He'd say, yeah, I know, but I'm working for NBC and I don't want to work for those guys. And we noticed he finally got up and just kept going. He hadn't made up his mind about anything. We hadn't changed his mind. We were just listening and talking and having a conversation about this kind of what this theater would be like, this thing would be like. And but we noticed after he walked away that the fried chicken was all gone and the potato salad was all gone. He'd talked all this time and eaten everything that we had. That was the first time I ever met John Belushi. And then when I did Animal House, I was sent in to audition for the Matheson part, for Otter, the guy who got all the girls. I thought that would be great. That's who I really wanted to be. But as soon as I walked through the door, Landis, the director, looked at me and said, do you know how to ride? And I said, without missing a beat, I said, yeah, I was practically born on a horse. My mother's water broke when she was out on a trail ride in our ranch in Montana, and she slid off the horse. My father helped her off. He delivered the baby right there in the shade of the horse. And then we got back on the horse, and I was in my mom's arms, and we rode back in. And Landis looked at me and said, yeah, sure. He knew I was lying. I'd made the whole thing up. So I told him five more lies about how I knew how to ride. And the next day he called me and said, I want you to do this part. And he must have liked the way I lied or something. But I said, oh, great. Okay, good. Do you think you can get Universal to give me some money so I can learn how to ride? So Landis cast me without me actually having to audition. I didn't have to read lines. But I did have to prove that I would be all right to the executives at Universal. So he said, it's just a formal thing. You just got to come in and do the audition. And I read with Michael Chinich, who was the casting director, who was a great guy. It was his casting that put all these people together, him and Landis, that put this group of people together. The chemistry was so good. So I got, he played Flounder, and I got to, and I had the script in my hand, even though I didn't need it, because I knew the lines, but I got to beat him with the script, and he had fun too, because I'll always remember him trying not to crack up as I was beating him and yelling at him and spitting on him. Because we did that scene, tuck up those pajamas. Is that a pledge pin on your uniform? Yeah, so we did all those. So that was the process, and they told me I had it.
Fat, disgusting slop. Redo those buttons. Dress that belt buckle. Straighten that cap. And tuck up those pajamas! What's that on your chest, mister?
It's a pledge pin, sir.
A pledge pin! On your uniform!
So, you cat, go away. John Landis had all the Delta House guys, Belushi, Jamie Widows, Bruce McGill as D-Day, Matheson, Otter, Boone, Riegert, had them all come out 5 days early before they started shooting. And then had the Omegas, myself and Jimmy Daughton, come out later, and Kevin Bacon, I think, came out just for a couple of days near the end. But I was there for the full 32 days. I didn't shoot every day. I had a lot of free time. But when you get to a movie set, the first thing you do is go to the production manager's office and get your per diem so you've got some money to get out of town if they change their mind. So I went in there, and Peter McGregor Scott, who was the production manager, gave me my per diem. And then he said, John Landis is over in the coffee shop in the Roadway Inn across the parking lot from where we were staying. He wants to see you right away. So leave your stuff here and go on over there and see John. You'll recognize him because you saw him when you auditioned, right? And I said, yeah, sure. So I went across the parking lot, went into this crowded coffee shop, and I see John in the corner at a table, at a booth, and I start walking towards him and wave to John, and John waves and waves me, come on over. I get about 10 or 15 feet away from the table, and Landis says, that's him, that's Niedermeyer, get him! And they start throwing food at me, real food at me, and yelling at me, calling me names. In the middle of this crowded, it was my introduction to Animal House. So I went, knowing it was all a gag, and understanding immediately what Landis was doing, that he was separating the two houses and creating this tension between them right away. I sat down and, you know, said hello to my friends but, you know, I knew I wasn't wanted, and I didn't want to be wanted by these guys anyway. So I left early. And then later on, a couple of days later, a day later, McGill stole a piano out of the lobby of the Roadway Inn and wheeled it across the parking lot to his room. And his room became Party Central. So I had the hotel move my room so it was right above his room. So because I wasn't going to go to Party Central, because Niedermeyer would never do that. But Niedermeyer would want to be close and take notes on who was there. So I had to move my room to right above his room. So the noise kept me up, and it would make me, I'd sit up all night long, while as long as they went on, spit polishing my boots and studying my script and just getting madder and madder and taking names and writing notes down to myself and developing my characterization. That was, and that was a great shoot, because it was, we were all the same. The genius of that movie is the script is really smart, really good. But also Landis and Ivan Reitman, they didn't cast any stars. Belushi wasn't really a star yet. He was doing, I think it was, we shot it in 77, and I think 76 was the first season of Saturday Night Live. So he was in the second season. People knew who he was, but he wasn't a big star yet. Everybody wanted us to put all, wanted them to put all Saturday Night Live people. They wanted Chevy to do the Tim Matheson part, Danny to do D-Day. They wanted to stack it that way. That was, they didn't like it at Universal, so they thought the only way to make get this thing to make money was to stack it with a lot of stars, a lot of movie stars. But Landis didn't want to do that. He held to his, he stuck to it, and he cast it all with actors, with real people who had craft and people who knew what they were doing. When it hit, it was, you know, there was a lot of, Universal hated it and really thought they were just going to dump it and it wasn't going to last at all.
Universal hated it and wanted to dump it. They didn't think it would last at all. And so often you'll hear about these artistic instincts of not stacking a movie with stars. And think about a lot of your favorites, whether it's Breaking Bad or it's The Sopranos. No stars. They were stars after, but they weren't stars at the beginning. And that's The Office and that's Seinfeld and on and on. When we come back, more of this remarkable storytelling and a fascinating life, Mark Metcalf's life, his life story here on Our American Stories.
Guys, this is Tori and Jenny with the 90210 OMG podcast. We have such a special episode brought to you by Nurtec ODT. We recorded it at iHeartRadio's 10th pole event, Wango Tango. Did you know that Nurtec ODT Remedipant 75 milligrams can help migraine sufferers still attend such an exciting event like Wango Tango? It's true. I had one that night and I took my Nurtec ODT and I was present and had an amazing time. Here's a little glimpse of our conversation with some of our closest friends. This episode was brought to you by Nurtec ODT Remegipant 75 milligrams. Life with migraine attacks can mean missing out on big moments with friends and family. But thankfully, Nurtec ODT Remegipant 75 milligrams is the only medication that is proven to treat a migraine attack and prevent episodic migraines in adults. So lively events like Wango Tango don't have to be missed.
Sometimes we all feel a little foggy in the morning. We forget our phone at home or leave a cup of coffee on the roof of our car and drive away. That's what junk sleep will do to you. It's that tossing and turning all night that comes from sleeping on the wrong mattress. That's no way to live. You need a restful night's sleep to be at your best every day. So head to Mattress Firm and get started on the quality sleep you deserve. Mattress Firm's highly trained sleep experts will help you find the perfect mattress. They'll use Mattress Matcher technology to connect you with the ideal sleep products, just by getting the answers to six simple questions. And then, finally, you can start getting the rest you need. No more sending emails to the wrong people. No more putting your car keys in the dishwasher. Talk to a sleep expert at Mattress Firm and unjunk your sleep today. Visit a Mattress Firm store near you or go to mattressfirm.com.
What up? It's Dramos. You may know me from the recap on LA TV. Now I've got my own podcast, Life as a Gringo, coming to you every Tuesday and Thursday. We'll be talking real and unapologetic about all things life, Latin culture, and everything in between from someone who's never quite fit in. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And we continue with our American stories. Let's pick up where we left off with Mark Metcalf telling the story of how Universal Pictures hated Animal House and were ready to dump it before its release in theaters. Here's Mark.
They did a screening in Denver, a test screening in Denver, and it happened to be on the same weekend that there was a big conference with the Greek fraternity organization conference. And they invite a lot of these guys, these Greeks, these fraternity people, got invitations to come to the screening. And they laughed so loud you couldn't hear the jokes because it was all about them. And Landis ran to the phone and called the people at Universal and held the phone up to the where the audience was and said, listen to this. And they're laughing their heads off. And Universal suddenly changed their mind and decided they had a hit. So, as I said, I lived in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and I would walk across St. Mark's to get on the subway. But every time I'd pass the corner right by the Gem Spa there, a panhandler would say, you know, he'd reach for money, and I wouldn't give him money, and he'd say, you're worthless and weak. And I was really hurt by this. I mean, I'd already done a couple other plays and was producing this movie and doing a lot of different things. So it never occurred to me that he was quoting this movie. And I just thought he's mad because I don't give him money. And I had made a decision because so many people have their hands out in New York and you can't give money to all of them. So I had made a decision to not give money to any of them unless they were playing a violin or really told me a good story. Every day he was there, I'd say, no, sorry. And I'd look right at him and say, no, I didn't ignore him. I'd say, sorry, I haven't got, can I, sir? And he'd say, you're worthless and weak. And, weeks later, I was sitting in a bar drinking a Rolling Rock in the West Bank Cafe with a friend of mine. And I tell him this story about this guy who keeps telling me I'm worthless and weak. We're talking about the homeless problem in New York. And the guy said, you idiot. He's quoting the movie. And I said, oh, yeah, I had that line, didn't I? Yeah.
You're all worthless and weak. Drop and give me 20.
So I didn't realize how big it was. Probably really, see, it came out in 78. So 6 years later, 84 is when Dee Snider called me and asked me to do the Twisted Sister video. And I didn't have a TV even. I didn't know what MTV was. I certainly didn't listen to that kind of music. As I always say, After Beethoven died, I stopped listening to popular music, which isn't true. I listened to a lot of blues, but I didn't know what that heavy metal rock and roll was, or hair bands, or any of that stuff. And when he called me and said, "Would you do this thing? We've been doing your lines in our act all up and down the Hudson River and all over Long Island for years. We love this movie and we love this character. We want you to be in our video." And that's when I think I realized then that it was a big thing. And then a friend of mine, the son of a friend of mine, had gone to Annapolis, and I visited, and he came over and he was saying, "Yeah, when in Annapolis, we used to call our drill instructors Toll, but now we call him Niedermeyer." I figured I'd done something good then. Yeah, so first of all, Dee asked me to do it. I said, yeah. So they flew me out Sunday after I did the matinee, and then I flew out on the red eye. And Dee picked me up at the airport. But there's this big guy, 6'2", 6'3", really kind of, I call him the ugliest man in the world, which is not true, but he's pretty ugly. And long blonde hair with, I found out later is a lot of it is extensions. And he's a big, muscular guy. And he met me, but he's like this big puppy dog. He's so excited to meet Niedermeyer. And he drives me back to where I'm going to stay, which I didn't know where I was going to stay. I thought I'd stay in a hotel, but they couldn't afford a hotel, so I slept on Marty Kollner's couch. Marty Kollner was the director of it. And they picked me up, not in a limo or anything like that, but in a little Datsun or some kind of car. And as we're driving back to Kollner's house, so I could... Dee is telling me what this thing is that we're going to do, because I had no idea. It's like a Roadrunner cartoon. You're Wile E. Coyote, and we're the Roadrunner, and you just all kinds of bad things happen to you. But we want you to open it up by doing it like a, you know, 1-2 minute monologue yelling at your son.
"I know what that is. That's music.
And the only, and you've got to write this tonight, you've got to write this because we're going to film it tomorrow. The only thing you have to do is you have to finish with the line, 'What do you want to do with your life?' And then we answer, 'I want to rock.' And that's then the music starts."
"All right, mister, what do you think you're doing? You call this a room? This is a pigsty. I want you to straighten up this area now! You are a disgusting slob! Stand up straight! Tuck in that shirt! Adjust that belt buckle! Tie those shoes! What kind of a man are you? You're worthless and weak! You do nothing! You are nothing! You sit in here all day and play that sick, repulsive, electric twanger! I carried an M16 and you carry that guitar! Who are you? Where do you come from? Are you listening to me? What do you want to do with your life?"
So I went and got from a friend of mine, Rex Weiner, and we drank beer and talked about this thing all night. He's a writer. He created a character named called Ford Fairlane that Andrew Dice Clay played. So he and I wrote to shape this sort of little monologue yelling at my son. My favorite line of his was, "I carried an M16 in the war and you carry that electric twanger." But after I did it, and it played every 5 minutes on MTV, I guess. But people started recognizing me then, not from Animal House, but from that. Stuff started happening. And then I get a letter from Universal that basically says, "You can't do that character. We own that character." So they said, "If you do it again, we'll sue you." I also get a letter from Screen Actors Guild because it was not a union gig. I got those two letters threatening me, and then like the next day or something like that, Dee calls and said, "They really like this video, obviously. We're going to do it again." I said, "All right, let's go."
"Twisted Sister. What kind of a man desecrates a defenseless textbook? I've got a good mind to slap your fat face. You are destroying
all the class. What do you want to do with your life?
I want to rock.
So I didn't care what they said. And they never came after me. They never sued me. They never threw me out of the union. I'm really proud of the work. I really like the work. The problem that I had with it is that I let myself be typecast. I let myself just do that part. And an actor has a bigger range than what people tend to know him as. And so it's nice to have 1, 2, 3 parts, really, because there's a whole generation of young women, mostly, who grew up loving Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I play a character called the Master in the first season of that, the oldest, meanest vampire around. Seinfeld, great bunch of people to work with, really good writers, some of the best writing on TV.
Well, hey, Maestro!
Hey, Kramer.
I'm in here. How's it going?
Fine.
Yeah.
Hi, Bob. I'm sorry, Maestro.
This is a surprise, huh? Look at
you. I just wanted to drop off this Chinese balm for your burns. Supposed to be great stuff. It's all herbal.
Oh, Maestro, what are you doing? You don't have to do this. Do you believe this, Maestro?
It's nothing. Oh.
Hello.
Well, hello. And who might you be?
I might be Elaine.
This is Bob Cobb. Maestro.
Oh, Maestro.
It is my very great pleasure.
Oh, enchanté.
So I've been really lucky getting good writers and getting those three parts, but there's three parts that are all different parts of me, but they also they do reflect this sort of authoritarian notion, which is a thing that I've fought against all my life and really don't like authoritarians. So I guess there's a little self-loathing in my work or something like that. I don't know.
And thanks, as always, to Greg Hengler for getting us this great story. Mark Metcalf's story, here on Our American Stories.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. We had a great time recording this episode for you guys before heading to our iHeartRadio Music Festival in Las Vegas. Thanks to Hyundai for making this possible. Here's a little taste. Let's play the game where I list an artist and let's watch you sing one of their songs.
Yes.
Oh, boy, this is going to be
Black
tough.
Black Eyed Peas.
I got a feeling
good.
Tonight's going to be
okay, just
good,
stop.
Good
hey,
night.
Just stop. Stop while you're ahead.
Lionel Richie.
You're beautiful.
No, that's James Blunt. No.
Okay.
Okay.
Lionel Richie. Hello.
No, that's Adele from the other side.
Similar-ish, but Lionel Richie was first. Pat Benatar. I give you the first word. Hit.
Hit me, baby, one more time.
Close. So close.
That's Britney Spears.
Oh, that is.
This episode brought to you by the first ever fully electric Hyundai Ioniq 5.
Geico asks, how would you love a chance to save some money on insurance? Of course you would. And when it comes to great rates on insurance, Geico can help. Like with insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, and RV. Even help with homeowners or renters coverage. Plus, add an easy-to-use mobile app, available 24-hour roadside assistance, and more. And Geico is an easy choice. Switch today and see all the ways you could save. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com or contact your local agent today.
Guys, are you getting up multiple times a night to use the bathroom? As we get older, so do our prostates, and that can mean urinary problems that affect our sleep and quality of life. Life is better outside the bathroom. Real Health's Prostate Complete can help you relieve those annoying and painful prostate symptoms. Available at Walmart or visit realhealth.com for more information and to order yours today. Try it risk-free with our 120-day money-back guarantee. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any disease.